We've all heard these ads.
This is Humira helping to relieve my pain and protect my joints from further damage.
For my type of chronic dry eye, over-the-counter drops aren't enough. So I also use what I prescribe for many of my patients, Restasis.
That's why you should ask your doctor about Diovan. Diovan relaxes and widens blood vessels, allowing blood to flow more easily, reducing your blood pressure.
But the big question is, how much have you spent on prescription drugs? According to a 2017 survey by Consumer Reports, more than half of American adults regularly take a prescription medication. So what's the average cost per year?
$1,433.
And many of you, our listeners, say the crunch of paying for prescriptions is real.
My name is Susan. My husband has Parkinson's. Our drug bill costs at least $500 a month, sometimes more. We don't do vacations anymore.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. It cost me about two-thirds of my Social Security check. One drug I get from the manufacturer, the copay on that would be about $3,000 per month. I spend $1,100 of my $1,660 Social Security check just on insurance and copays for drugs.
My name is Susan. I am on Social Security. I'm from Spartanburg, South Carolina. My monthly prescription costs are an average of $467 a month. I don't know how I'm going to be able to pay that cost.
It's a decades-long problem in the United States, but under a Trump presidency, things were supposed to change.
My administration is launching the most sweeping action in history to lower the price of prescription drugs for the American people. We've wanted to be doing this. We've been working on it right from day one.
That was the president back in May. Here he is again in October, right before the midterms.
We're fighting for lower drug prices, which will now be automatic. It will be automatic and very substantial.
After raising prices in the first half of 2018, the pharmaceutical drug industry got heat from the Trump administration. And in the second half of 2018, there was a self-imposed pause by some of these companies to halt price increases. But in 2019, it seems they're reversing course. According to a Reuters investigation, at least 28 pharmaceutical companies are expected to increase the price of more than 250 drugs this year. And that leaves Americans spending more on prescription medications than any other wealthy country. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin The Takeaway. Here to help us explain what this means for American consumers and the political fight to control prescription drug prices are Zach Carter, a senior reporter with the Huffington Post, and Craig Garthwaite, a strategy professor and the director of healthcare at the Kellogg School of Management. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, Craig, let's get started with you. We just mentioned in the segment that Americans pay more for drugs than almost any other wealthy country. How did we get to this point?
Well, as a country, we've decided that we're not going to directly try and use our market power to drive down the price we pay for drugs. And I think it's a reasoned political calculus that we worry about providing the appropriate incentives to develop new drugs in the future. And that we think this innovation is really beneficial to society. Other countries have made a different choice. And frankly, their choice is made easier by the fact that the United States is effectively willing to fund innovation for the entire world. And so they can effectively free ride on the money that the United States spends on drugs.
No, we're doing that research, though, and Americans are paying for it, essentially, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a great situation. I think it's better than the situation where no one pays for it. And that's my worry about sort of the United States pulling back a lot on drug pricing, is that if those profits go away, we really diminish the incentives for future products that will treat conditions for which there are currently no options. And so we're trading off sort of access today where people have to pay high prices, so maybe they don't get all the drugs they want today, in order to create access in the future for new treatment options. So people who have pancreatic cancer or other horrible conditions today that are effectively death sentences, we want to provide the incentives to create treatments for those diseases in the future.
So Craig, why don't just step back a second? The prices that we're going to see don't necessarily reflect the sticker prices at the end of the day, right? So there's a lot of negotiation. There's a lot of back and forth between insurance companies, doctors, consumers. What does the increase do actually?
So, I mean, one, it's a input into this negotiation. So it is going to have an effect on the net price that's paid. the actual sort of price the insurer pays. The other thing that's important for pharma is that it is going to affect people, what people spend when they're in their deductible period. So when you're in your deductible period, you pay that list price for the drug. It's going to affect what you pay if you have a percentage-based coinsurance. So if you're on the hook for 20% of the price of the drug, that's 20% of that list price of the drug, and it's going to affect the uninsured. So, I mean, like everything in pharma, it's complicated, but it's not directly the price the insurer pays, but for an increasing fraction of Americans, it is going to be the price they pay for a portion of the year.
Zach, I want to bring you in here for a second. President Trump, as we mentioned, made lowering prescription drug prices a big central argument for his campaign. What has he actually done so far? We've heard a lot of rhetoric, but what's he actually done?
Very little. The rhetoric is really the extent of the policy change we've seen under the Trump administration. A voluntary price freeze from the pharmaceutical industry is a break with recent, very recent history, but the long-term trends haven't changed. The administration had talked about maybe providing a little more transparency in prescription drug ads. So when you see an ad for Humira, for instance, on television, there has to be a little price tag telling people how much this stuff costs. I think the idea there is to sort of shame drug companies into bringing down prices. Because
are they able to be shamed?
It doesn't seem so. High prescription drug prices in the United States are not a secret. We have a scandal of some variety every 6 or 8 months, and the prices keep going up. I mean, I think we can remember a few years ago, EpiPens, I think, more than doubled their price. They're still that high price. They didn't go down because of the public scrutiny. So it's very clear that you have a situation of market failure in the pharmaceutical industry where there is no competitive pressure on these companies, encouraging them to bring down the price of life-saving medicine. And there's no ability for consumers to negotiate down when their lives are on the line.
And let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, why has this been so important for the Trump administration? Why is he sort of latched onto this, even though he hasn't done actually much to change it?
I mean, I find psychoanalyzing the president very difficult, but I will say during his campaign, this did seem like an issue just based on the theater criticism of the rallies and the debates where he actually did seem to care. And you saw it very early in his presidency. I think before he was even in office, he gave a press conference talking about prescription drug prices and how he was going to bring prices down. But he then had a meeting with pharmaceutical executives, and suddenly the agenda went away. And if you look at what the administration has done on trade policy, for instance, it's made NAFTA a top priority for the administration. And there are a lot of critics of NAFTA who'd say on things like labor, he's actually made some progress that I think Democrats and progressives would be enthusiastic about. But the flip side of that has been towing the pharma line on intellectual property. And so he's advocated for or pressed for longer and stronger monopolies on prescription drugs in North America through that policy platform.
Craig, you talked a little bit about the fact that the research that we do in the United States on these drugs is essentially helping drug development across the world. It's giving us access to drugs, improved drugs in the future. But it still seems to be a really literally high price to pay. We just heard a bunch of callers saying that they're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month on prescription drugs. What would it take, Craig, at a policy level to bring these prices down?
I think we'd have to start making some adult choices about how we want to trade off access today and access later. So I would disagree a bit that there's a market failure here. For brand name drugs, it's not a market failure. It's a policy decision where we provide patents that offer monopolies to drug companies to recoup their R&D costs.
Well, I guess, failure to whom? Is it a failure for the consumer? Is it a failure for the company?
Well, I would note that market failure is a particular term. It's a state that the market's not working, right? That's not what's happening here. It's a choice we've made to provide a monopoly. If we want prices to go down, we've got to be willing to say no to some of these drugs. I said earlier that we have this innovation access trade-off. It might be that we are providing too strong of an incentive for innovation because every new drug that comes out, we're willing to pay for, we pay for, no matter how incrementally improvement. And we might want to say to some of these products, you know, listen, we're not willing to pay for it, and so it's nice that you developed this drug, but it doesn't justify the price you're charging. But that means saying no. It means insurance companies not covering the drug. It means Medicare walking away from an oncology product for cancer if we don't get the price we want. And frankly, as Americans, we don't seem to be willing to do that. That's an adult conversation. That's saying, hey, we're going to provide the right signal to the market. Instead, what we want, what the president is saying, and frankly, Democrats are saying as well, is we're going to get both lower prices and access to all the drugs we want. And that's fantasy land. That's not the world we live in.
This is all based on the assumption that you give monopolies to prescription drug companies in order to create these incentives. These choices are created by the fact that these companies do not have market pressures facing them. And when we talk about market failure in the prescription drug market, we have to talk about the innovations that aren't happening. Doctors will tell you that there is a shortage of antibiotics coming for antibiotic-resistant infections. There isn't enough research going into that area. It's just one example. There's a lot of research going into hair loss drugs. It's not obvious that we need to be spending money on hair loss drugs instead of antibiotic-resistant antibiotics. So there are clearly treatments that we're not getting right now that the market is not addressing. It's difficult to measure that because these things simply don't exist. It's hard to measure something that doesn't exist. But the federal government pays a lot of money for research into pharmaceutical drugs. And pharmaceutical companies essentially take that research over the finish line. And they end up spending more money on marketing than they do on R&D. So the idea that this is the most efficient way to get money into innovation, I think, is a little silly. And when you look at trade policy, where really the front lines of this policy agenda exist, other countries look at the United States and its relationship with the pharmaceutical industry, and it looks corrupt.
I'd like to get your thoughts on that, Craig.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd like to say that it's not based on an assumption that this is the way they do. It's based on pretty solid economic research that what happens is that firms respond to potential profits. I agree we should have more investments in antibiotics, but that just shows that we need to find a way to pay for antibiotics that we want, right? And so what we need to do is we need to be willing to pay for more antibiotics. And I agree completely. I'd like to see things tilted towards that in the market. But the idea that sort of pharmaceutical companies are just at the margin taking products over the line, that the federal government invests a lot of money in R&D, just shows a lack of understanding of how pharmaceutical products come to market.
And I will jump in here. We got about a minute left, and I want to hear from you, Zach, before we wrap here. But I think the question here is that most people would argue, yes, we want innovation. People don't want to be sick and or, you know, saddled with these issues that are requiring these drug prices. But it seems like Americans are still being saddled with the bill. Zach?
I mean, we can have different intellectual property incentives within the monopoly framework. For instance, before 1995, when the WTO treaties were signed, patents were 17 years. WTO made them 20 years. It is not at all obvious that the existing status quo to finance big pharma, essentially, the incentives that Craig is talking about here are just profits. I mean, is there any upward limit at which profits stop incentivizing people? I don't think so. I mean, you could always just say, why not convert all of GDP to the pharmaceutical sector? That's providing more incentive for innovation. We have a history of turning over the levers of public policy to the pharmaceutical industry. They use them to charge higher prices.
Zach Carter is a senior reporter with the Huffington Post, and Craig Garthwaite is the director of healthcare at the Kellogg School of Management. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.